You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So the question before the court was, can you put a price tag on a creation of nature? Can our genetics be somehow someone else's intellectual property? That was what was before a federal district court in Manhattan, and the judge there ruled that a biopharmaceutical company could not patent genes, particularly two genes that are strongly associated with breast and ovarian cancer. But there are already 4,300 similar patents. That's about 20% of all the identified human genes. And this recent ruling has re-sparked an ethical debate over whether a natural creation, something that occurs naturally in our body, like genes, like DNA, can become someone's intellectual property and they can make a profit off it. We're rejoined by Dr. Wendy Chung, a plaintiff in this case, also a physician and genetics professor at Columbia University. Also with us, David Kepsel, author of Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, doctor, you are a practicing physician. You have patients who've dealt with breast or ovarian cancer. Why did you decide to join this case? What effect does it have for your patients?
So the effect that it's had on my patients is that they need to be able to take care of themselves to either prevent cancer or to be able to catch it very early, especially breast and ovarian cancer with these genes. And having the patents on these genes has decreased access to testing for them and not given them the best type of test that they could have to take care of themselves.
How has it done that?
Well, essentially by having a situation where you have a monopoly with only one company offering the testing, they've been able to set the price and decide what tests they've made available to patients and not really done a whole lot to improve it or to give patients the option of having a second opinion when there was some question or ambiguity about their test results.
So as I understand it, this company called Myriad identified this gene, got a patent on it, and said that it's associated with breast and ovarian cancer, and then because of their patent, they're able to charge about $3,000 for the test in the United States. But in Canada, where that patent is not honored, that same test costs less than $1,000.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. But we already have, as I said just a moment ago, 20% of all the genes we've identified are patented. How is this case different from these other genes that have patents already?
It's not, and that's actually the precedent, potentially precedenting sending issue about this case, is that if this is upheld, for instance, on appeal, then this is something that could be much more broadly applicable to all those other genes that have patents.
Okay, David Kepsel, let's talk to you for just a moment, because this case kind of deals with some pretty technical issues in terms of things that are naturally created and something which has been somehow created or changed or put to use by a specific individual or a company. Yesterday, one of our producers spoke with Dr. Ananda Chakrabarty, who patented genetically engineered microorganisms in 1980. And he says gene mutations can be patented if they show a function, a use, beyond just what the gene would be in its natural state. Here he is.
Simply because a piece of DNA has been isolated is not enough to secure a patent unless the utility has been shown. You know, during the last 3 years, we got 8 U.S. patents on bacterial proteins that appear to have anti-cancer, anti-HIV/AIDS, anti-malaria type of activity. Even though these are products of nature isolated from bacteria, we are showing a function that has never been reported before.
So is there a difference when you identify something that, although you haven't created it, you've shown a use to which it can be put?
I don't think so, and I think this gets to the heart of the perversion of the purposes of patent law that the judge is correcting with this decision. What the patent law should do is encourage people to innovate by creating new things. Now, using old things, things that exist in nature, for new purposes might be a patentable process, or you might be able to create a new machine using old principles of nature, and that new machine would be patentable. But in the case of the patents that existed on the BRCA1 and 2 genes and exist in many of these gene patents, the sequences we're talking about have existed for eons. They're results of evolution. They're not the creations of humans.
But David, it costs a huge amount of money to do the kind of research that not only identifies and isolates these portions of the DNA strand, but then associates them with a specific kind of cancer or other illness. That's a very expensive process.
Yeah, that money has generally come actually from both the private and public sector. You know, Dr. Mary Claire King, who first started to hone in on the location of the BRCA1 and 2 genes, she did her research with public funding largely. And that public funding was enough for her to be able to get very close, and it was part of a race that Mary had happened to win by inches. And she would have identified the gene herself using the public funds that she had from her grants. So, you know, the funding has always been there for the basic science. And the danger with these sorts of patents is that it will actually inhibit much of that basic science.
Dr. Chung, I want to play you this clip from journalist David Ewing Duncan. He researches and reports on new discoveries in biotechnology, and he says there is a way to make the patent system work as a business model. Here's what he has to say.
Radio frequencies, like the genome radio frequencies, have always been there. It's just we one day discovered them, and we decided back in the 1920s the radio frequencies would be owned by the public and then licensed out, and there could be controls and rules established by governments.
Dr. Chung, what do you think about that, that you would license out certain genes or portions of the genetic code to be used by biotech companies?
Sure, that is certainly one way that some companies have dealt with these, is to issue, for instance, non-exclusive licenses. There's also been talk of using patent pools and other things that wouldn't bring the same monopolistic market forces to bear, so that things would be at least better than they are for the situation with BRCA1 and 2. However, as Judge Sweet has been ruled in this case, there's a more fundamental question at heart, which is exactly what was argued, is whether or not these genes are patentable whatsoever.
And you know, if this ruling stands on appeal, which we don't know yet, it could end up reopening all these other patents, right?
That's exactly correct. If this is held up on appeal, this potentially could be precedent-setting in just the other way from the Chakravarti case.
Okay. Dr. Wendy Chung is a physician and genetics professor at Columbia University. She was a plaintiff in this case. And David Kepsel is author of Who Owns You? The Corporate Gold Rush to Patent Your Genes. Who owns natural genetic material? It's an ethical and philosophical question, but a legal question now, too.